contribute. And so, so there's two in terms of leading order. There's so we have N1 and plus. And this could be Z. And there's a similar graph where the same thing is a photon between. And that's it, the leading order for this particular process. Unless if F is electron, then there's other graphs that are possible, because then there's graphs like E minus. And that could be a photon or a Z. Another. If it happens that F is an electron neutrino, then there's another graph we could have. We have E minus nu plus R at W. So this is only there for this process, this is only there for this process, but for anything else, this is the story. So for this process, we have that plus that plus that squared. For this one, we have this plus that squared. And then for everything else, we have just that squared. So I'm going to focus on this one, where F is, so we'll choose F not to be an electron, to not be a neutrino. Come back to that later on. As you'll see, this kind of a process is called, these things are called S-channel processes. And that's because the momentum, the propagator that appears here is going to essentially be 1 over this momentum, k squared plus m squared minus I epsilon. And k squared is the sum of the initial momenta squared. So that's basically 1 over s minus m squared minus I epsilon in terms of the Mendelssohn variables. And in the same sense, this if you look at what this is, this momentum flowing here is the difference between, say, the initial electron and the final electron. And so that is what would be t here. So this is the propagator here would be 1 over t minus m squared. That's my epsilon. So this is, these kind of graphs are, because of that, called t channel processes.
I have a question about the last graph. How exactly do you tell whether that's a W plus or minus? Is this depending on your interpretation of the graph? Or?
Well, for the propagator, it's kind of a, it's 6 of 1 half of the other. You know what happened, because the electron was destroyed, so this had to create a W minus the charge flowing that way in the graph. And so the charge flow is the thing that, if I did arrows here, and I don't know if I was doing that in the last time to measure the, I think I did actually, to draw the charge flow, then the charge flow is flowing around that way. And you can think of this as being Fermi number flow, which is 0 here. And here, I've kind of done it. This is negative charge. So I guess that my conventions are that the arrows are negative charge, electric charge flow, but positive Fermi number flow. So they can coincide here. So this is just charge, and that's just Fermi number. So let's start off with that. So our S matrix, let's take some of these same variables that they use in here. Just to make sure that it's stupid. P, P prime, K, K prime. So we'll take a fermion with momentum K, an antifermion with momentum K prime, initial electron with momentum P, positron with momentum P prime. And that's going to be given by, we can just read off the graph. So there's a 1 over 2 factorial, because it's a second order graph. There's going to be some statistical factor, because we had to have a fermion coming out. We had to have an antifermion coming out. Electron is coming in, and an anti-electron is coming in. We have two vertices. So this is like, this is the turning of electrons, and like this is the electron, that's the turning. So that was the electron there, this is the electron. So as far as counting goes, how many ways can we connect the graph up? There's only one way to connect these lines. There's only one way, this line has to connect to here, because the electron has to flow that way. That has to connect to here. That has to connect to here, and then has to connect to there. So there's only one way to do it. So there's no statistical factors apart from the, you know, so the statistical factor is one. There's no signs involved in changing the orders of the, there's no relative sign between those two graphs because of the changing of the orders of the of Fermion operators. For each vertex, we have a factor of pi over 4. And then for the propagator, we have a 1 over that. There's an integral. So we have p flowing in, p prime flowing in, k flowing out, k prime flowing out. Let's call this q.
Sorry, can I ask something?
Yep.
Why can't you have a base?
You could have x. But it's I'm not going to do it because it's the coupling here are so small. So the first statement is right that you could have. But this is proportional to the Kao coupling of the electron squared, or electron times the Kao coupling of the fermion. And then we square the whole thing, right? Whereas this is got the electric charge squared. And the thing is, this is the electron is 10 minus 6 in the Kao coupling because it's the mass divided by the Higgs bound. And if this is a, even if this is a top quark, when the biggest this is ever, when this is a top quark, it's the same size as an electric charge. So the thing is that in practice, although this is there, it's fully swamped by using things that are much bigger because the coupling is much smaller. But it's there. And in principle, if it was there with a competitive sign size, you could pick it apart because it depends differently on spins than what I'm going to show you. So that would be a good exercise I could do. But do the because it tends to be that in the limit of the masses are small, that these graphs, when you square this thing, the interference between this and everything else tends to cancel. The interference is proportional to the mass. So the electron and the fermion mass is negligible compared to the energy involved. And it's actually not a big deal that you can just to add that extra piece. But you're right, it's there. There's an integral, so d4, what's I calling it? Q. And I want to write that integral before I write the delta function. So there's a delta function for each vertex. Delta 4 t plus q prime minus q. And then we have the relevant interaction, remember, is the visible current interaction. That was IE or sine theta. Let's say the Z mu gamma bar times gamma bar gamma mu G left, G right, gamma right. And then those G's were numbers that were given in terms of the charges that were called. So let's write down the electron and the fermion parts are common to those two graphs. So what differs in the graphs is really the coupling to the boson, so I should also write the electromagnetic one, i.e. a mu fermion bar mu charge summed over fermions. So the let me do the fermion. So we've got two fermion lines, and I want to walk backwards along the fermion number. So let's do the electron first. So we can start off with the positron. It's a V spinner bar with momentum P. And there's the vertex gamma mu. And there's, let me call this M sub vector, where M sub vector is a matrix, which is equal to 1, for it's equal to electric charge of that fermion if the vector is a photon, that's equal to g left, gamma left, plus g right, gamma right, if g is equal to z. And since I'm doing this, why don't I just also divide by sine theta w and cosine w here? And then the only difference between these interactions is they have a common factor e. So I can pull out a factor of e squared here. So I'll put that up front. E squared. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to sum over the two graphs by having the sum over the vector being the photon and the z. And I just want to identify what depends on the specific to the different kinds of particles. Then I have the incoming electron that fills off the spinner. That's one thing. At the other end, I've got the same thing for the fermion, the final fermion. So if I start at the end of the fermion number flow, that's the fermion. So it'll be u bar k, gamma nu, m vector. And I should actually put a subscript here. This is this depends on the fermion we're talking about. So it's I'll put a superscript f. So it's the q for the fermion. And these g's depend on which fermion we're talking about. So I need to put, this is the one that involves electrons. And this is the one that involves whatever the final fermion was. I have a final v spinner. And then I need a propagator for the gauge boson. So that'll be a mu nu plus, in the unitary gauge, it'll be mu nu divided by the appropriate vector mass squared, divided by q squared plus the vector mass squared minus my epsilon. That's it, right? You can see what would happen if we had that big, because it would be this factor here would now just have a u bar u, a v bar v, then the Higgs propagator would just be 1 over q squared plus mv squared, and we have to add that to this whole thing. All right. So now you square that baby, you keep all the terms, you take the spin, the vv bars, and the sum over spins of those things, and you write those as a drag trace, and you turn the crank. Let me just tell you what the answer is. And I'm also going to neglect the mass of the fermions compared to the z mass. So in practice, this term here, I'm going to be able to neglect. So I'm going to neglect m fermion and m electron squared divided by m vector squared and z squared. So the upshot is that the m squared bar, by which I mean I have to sum over the final, I'm not going to follow spins here, so I'm going to sum over the final spins. I'm going to average over the initial spins. How many initial spins were there? There was two each for each of these guys, so there's four possible spin combinations here. So the average over the initial spins will be 1/4 sum over the spins here, and I'll sum over those spins. So there's 1/4 sum over all the spins. M is defined as usual, where S is, minus 2 pi, 2 to the 4th pi, 1 to the 4th, P plus P pi, minus A plus P pi. So that, in the approximations I gave, boils down to something which is really nice. So it's the number of colors. That's the, if F was a quark, mu or tau is equal to 3 if f is a quark. Because you have to sum over all the final state things, and if it's a quark, there's 3 colors for each. Times e squared. So now we have a beautiful thing happens. This a bunch of cross terms go away in the sum when you neglect these masses. So, the absolute value of the sum of this region. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to define d left electron for the photon to be the charge of the fermion, and that's going to be equal to g electron right for the photon. If I do that, then I'm going to actually define the c's and the signs and the cosines to be inside the g's. So if I do that, the point of this exercise is going to be that the only difference between the photon and the z is then just what I'm calling is g left, g right. So I can write an expression which is just a sum over the couplings rather than a sum over the matrices. So notationally, it's going to make this thing easier to write. So then g electron, that's the sum over photon and z. G electron left. G. Divided by S minus M vector squared. G squared. And then the left right terms. So that's remarkably simple once the dust settles. And it's kind of a simple physical interpretation along the lines of the interpretation I gave you for the decay of a polarized Z. There was an interplay there. Remember, for the decay of a polarized Z boson, there was the angular dependence of how the electron came out or the fermion came out was. There was a simple, the answer depended like on this work of the sine square theta, where theta was the angle between the polarization vector and the outgoing momentum, in the limit that the mass of the fermion was zero. And so it vanished in particular when theta was zero or pi. And there was a simple understanding for why that would be true, because which was based on the interplay between conservation of angular momentum and conservation of velocity, which is observed in the limit that the fermion mass is zero. And since we're working in limit with fermion mass of zero here, there's a similar story as to why these u's and t's are in the answer and why the answer breaks up into a sum of squares. So the thing is that in the limit that the mass is zero, then helicity is conserved. So the left-handed and right-handed fermions, there's nothing in the standard model which makes them turns one into the other. And so helicity would actually be a really good compact, would be a conserved quantum number in that case. And so in that limit, that means that the different choices for the handedness of the electron become physically distinguishable choices. So that the total rate for something to happen as a function of the total rate for producing a fermion pairs of arbitrary helicity and starting with electrons of an arbitrary helicity is going to have to break up in that limit to the sum of the squares of the rates Start again. For the full answer, felicity is not conserved. And so you're not allowed to specify the initial final state using felicity, so you have to just calculate the amplitude as we did and square it. But in the limit of the mass is zero, felicity becomes conserved. And because it's conserved, we know that it distinguishes the initial and final states. So what had been indistinguishable states are now distinguishable, and the answer had to be, the total rate had to be the sum of the rates for the distinguishable initial and final states. So if we had known that felicity was conserved to start off with, we could have calculated the total rate for this process to happen by doing it felicity by felicity, squaring the amplitude for each one and then summing them all up. The answer had to have that form, because quantum mechanics always gives you the sum of rates if the initial and final states were distinguishable. And algebra gave us that answer, and that's why it gave us the answer. It's a sum of four different rates. And you can explicitly see that these terms each correspond to a different choice for the felicity of the fermions involved, because those couplings, G left and G right, came with the projectors onto the left and right-handed parts of the fields. And so it was literally G left and G right for each of these bosons is telling you the strength with which the particle of that felicity couples to the corresponding gauge boson. And so the top term is where everybody's left-handed, the second term is where everybody's right-handed, and the last two are the case where these guys are left-handed and these guys are right-handed, or these guys are right-handed and these guys are left-handed. And those are all possible if felicity is conserved. Because felicity is conserved along the fermion line, it just says if the electron is left-handed, the positron has to also be left-handed, so that that's the only channel that can annihilate into a Z in the limit of the fermions are massless. So the sum of the squares is kind of a miracle when you do it, but it kind of had to come up that way if you think about it a little bit. The 1 over S minus MV squared is kind of obvious, because that's just really this overall propagator for each of the gauge bosons. This term has died, and it dies because it's proportional to the mass of the fermion involved divided by MV squared, and I've neglected that for the Z boson. For the photon, this term is not here. This would have been the same. The photon mass is zero. So this is what this term here is for the Z only element, right? For the photon, this unitary gauge doesn't exist because the mass of the photon is zero, and so a morphing beam, bless you, gauge is Feynman gauge, and the Feynman gauge is one for which that term is not there for the photon. But since we're neglecting the fermion masses anyway, this term is just irrelevant for both of them, and so then the propagator is just this denominator, and that's what's gone along for the ride everywhere, where MV is zero for the case of photons. All that's left is the U and T dependence, and the U and T dependence has an explanation which is very similar to the one for Z decay. Remember, in the center mass frame, T was S was minus P plus P prime squared. And if everybody is approximately massless, or neglecting masses, that's approximately equal to minus 2 P left P prime. So in terms of the energy of the electron and the positron, that's basically minus 2 E squared, because these energies are the same in the center mass frame. If P and P is equal to P prime, minus P prime, because they're back to back. Since they have the same mass, these fermions, that means that the E sub P is equal to E sub P prime. So these energies are the same in the center mass frame. And that was stupid what I just wrote there. Sorry. This is true. But if I want to actually write this, this is twice. If I add this up, the momenta cancel and the energies add. So it's like twice the energy. And so this is it's 4 times the energy of the electron. Because P dot P prime is twice the energy. So there's an infinite energy time dependent. The time component gives you a contribution, and the space component gives you a contribution. So that's what S is. What about T? What I'm going to do is I'm thinking of this as being P sub A, this is P sub B, I take the fermion to be P sub C, and this will be P sub D. So this is P minus K squared. And so that's, if everybody's approximately massless, that's 2 P dot K. So if I think of P mu and the center mass frame being E, 0, 0, E, because they're relativistic, and so I'm thinking the mass is probably 0. So P prime in that same frame would be E, 0, 0, minus E. And the way I wrote things before, K would have been the energy, if they're massless, has to be the same again, because if they're, the momentum are equal and opposite, and if they're massless, the momentum is the energy, but the energy conservation says that the total energy before had equal total energy afterwards. So two massless particles, like two massless particles, have to produce the same energy in center mass. So this would be zero E sine theta, zero B cosine theta. And K prime in that frame would be E minus E sine theta, zero minus E. So this dot product is easy to evaluate. We want this, not that, great, minus 2, also 2 E squared, minus 1 from the energy times the energy, and then there's a plus cos theta from the z components. So that says that T is minus 2 E squared 1 minus cosine theta. Same thing if I did it for you. The only difference would have been that I would have had K prime here. So that becomes K prime, and so all these things reverse. So this changes the sign of the cosine theta. So we would have gotten, in that case, minus 2 E squared 1 plus cosine theta. So this factor here, the T squareds and the U squareds, are really factors of 1 minus cosine theta squared, and U squared is a factor of 1 plus cosine theta squared. That's expressing the fact that this is going to vanish if theta is 0 or pi. And this is going to vanish when theta is pi by 2, or minus pi by 2, right? Pi by 2. No, I like it there, right? Cosine of pi is minus 1, so that's 0 to pi. This is pi. And so it's, you can understand why this thing vanishes in that limit. So when you've got two left-handed or two right-handed things, the argument is that they have to vanish when theta is 0. What's it mean for theta to be 0? The initial electron comes in like this along the z-axis, and the initial positron comes in like that. And then the, since I'm saying that the T sub C is K, which is the fermion, I'm saying the fermion comes out like that, and that angle there is theta. And so the anti-fermion comes out in the center of mass frame like that. So when theta is zero, that means that the fermion came out in exactly the same direction as the electron did. And if theta is pi, it means that the fermion comes out in the opposite direction of the electron. And so, if you think about how it worked for the Z boson, we're looking for an argument as to why these cases are forbidden by the combination of helicity conservation and angular momentum conservation. So we need to think about what the angular momentum is at the initial state in these two cases. So let's take the cases that are proportional to U squared. That's the left-handed fermion and the left-handed final fermion, or both right-handed, but they both have the same handedness. So in that case, I've got a left-handed particle. So the interaction that does the destroying has the moral structure of something like this, right? So it's got an F left bar with an F left, or an F right bar with an F right. So it destroys a left-handed fermion, and it creates a left-handed anti-fermion. I said that right. I always get this wrong. Oh, I've gotten wrong. I also did wrong. So, what is F bar? Is it F dagger, theta, gamma mu, say gamma left, F? So that's left-handed because it's got gamma left acting on it. If I take the gamma left past this, it's gamma right. Take it here, it's gamma left. So that's F left dagger, That's right. So I got a left-handed. I've got two left-handed fields. This is the same argument I gave you for the ZK, and I'm getting it. I always have a kind of trouble with it. So it's not, yeah, they're both left-handed, but they're back-to-back. Right? So the electron and the positron are left-handed. This is very regular. So this destroys the left-handed particle, but it creates its antiparticle, which is a right-handed antiparticle, because CPT changes the sign of the handedness. Because you know, helicity is p dot momentum dot spin, and so if you change the both parity and time reversals, that changes sign. So if you have a left-handed particle, its antiparticle is a right-handed antiparticle. So this field, it's the same field, so it's creating a left-handed particle. If it's creating, destroying a left-handed particle, that means it's destroying a right-handed antiparticle. So that means that if the particle was left-handed, it was a right-handed antiparticle that was going the other direction. So here's my left-handed particle, here's my right-handed antiparticle. The spins in the same direction as the point. So since they're coming at each other back-to-back, the component of momentum in this direction is plus or minus 1, depending on if it's left or right. So J sub Z is plus or minus 1, depending on which one I'm looking at here. But for both those first two cases, it's like that. And that's also true for the final one. The final one, for the fermion and the antifermion, you know, if this is left-handed, it'll be like that, this will be right-handed. But again, they have the same spin. So again, this is going to be J in this direction. Call this, you know, this is the N direction, and J sub N is plus or minus 1. So in the limit that this thing should be, if everybody's left-handed, this should be allowed when they're parallel, but it should be not allowed when they're opposite, because if they're parallel, they have exactly the same, the fermion that came in as the fermion that went out, so that the angular momentum didn't change by that argument. But when the fermion comes out in the opposite direction, then, you know, if originally had the left-handed fermion and the right-handed antifermion like this, the spin was that way. But if the final fermion is going out that way, and the antifermion is going out that way, then my spin is the opposite direction. So I have, if this was J equals plus 1 for the initial state, it would have been J equals minus 1 for the final state, if the final fermion goes out the opposite direction of the initial fermion. So that means that the whole amplitude would have to vanish in that limit, because you would have had change angular momentum around that point by 2 units, which you can't do, because the whole thing conserves angular momentum. So that means that the answer has to vanish in the limit that you go in the back direction, which is pi, which is u squared, which is why those first terms vanish by u squared. You can also tell why it's u squared, not some other power of u. It had to be a square or something because the amplitude didn't vanish. And so the, if you think about the overlap between angular momenta at a fixed angle of angular momentum 1 and angular momentum 1, then that overlap is the angle that you're getting here. You're being, the spin mismatch is being made up by an angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, and that orbital angular momentum has a wave function, which is one plus plus up there. So now, if it's the opposite case, if we start off with the left, so the thing that the last term is the left and the right. So if this guy was left-handed, the final fermion is right-handed. So the same argument goes through. But now the thing that's forbidden is if the final fermion goes in the same direction as the initial fermion, because then you flip the sign of the total angular momentum, the spin angular momentum, because you've gone from a left-handed electron to a right-handed final fermion, whatever it was, a muon, let's say. So that's why the answer had to vanish in that case at 0, and that's why those two terms are like t squared. So that whole answer is really, really simple. And it has a nice, clean physical interpretation in this limit that all the masses are small. So it's really useful to derive that much, because it's a really useful expression to have, and to you can interpret it very easily whenever you apply it. So if I define, if we now specialize what these couplings are for the Z and the photon, so I'm going to define AIJ, where this is left and right, to be that's 1 over sine theta w, cos theta w. Square. Times g electron I and g fermion j divided by plus minus mz squared. So this now, I don't put a photon or a z label on it because this is the one that I've been talking about right along with the z boson. And the photon part will just be the electric charge electron and the charge fermion divided by s. So with that definition, I equals L R R, and you know, G fermion left was, I think everybody wrote it here. Well, we can reconstruct it. So it's Q3 F minus Q F sine squared theta. And G fermion right was minus Q fermion sine squared theta. So in terms of the, you know, the hypercharge and the electric charge, you know everything. And the cross section, so I'm just plugging in this expression for m squared into the expression for the cross section as 4. And the caveat is that the fermion cannot be an electron, and it cannot be a neutrino, electron neutrino. So 8 pi squared alpha squared over s and c for s times a left for s squared a right for s squared a left right for s. Times the phase space. The phase space, dchi. And what's dchi? Dchi is, you can do it once for all. It's Lorentzian, right? One thing, because the whole answer is.
So it's 2 pi to the fourth.
This is the way it comes to you.
We have 2,
9, 6, plus a 0.
But you can just use the definitions to rewrite that in an interesting way as
minus 1 over 8 pi delta of S Q U. Minus the sum of the mass squareds, in this case, I'm giving an expression here which would have been true for any arbitrary data.
And so,
in our case, we've been neglected this to be approximately zero because we've used the masses that are negligible. So, so that gives you the cross section as a function of the invariant variables, and you can always, it's traditional to, you know, you can do the inter, but this just expresses the fact that S and D and U are not independent of one another. It comes to you as the, what the way you get this is that the you use the three spatial dimensions delta functions to do one of these integrals. And then the remaining delta function would have been doing the integral over the modulus of K prime, but you don't do that integral. You just leave the delta function there. And that's what this, it turns into this one when you change variables to U and T from the remaining variables, you do the integral over the azimuth angle, which is drops over the problem. You would then integral over theta and then modulus of k prime. And that's what you change variables to u and t using definitions. And then the delta function just ends up expressing the fact that u and t are not independent. So you can always do it with the, you can always remove du, let's say, the delta function, and think of this as being a differential cross section d sigma dt. So with that choice, it's just, you know, just read it off. We got minus 8 pi alpha squared n sub c over s squared, square bracket, and nothing. It might bother you to have this be negative, but it's the square bracket here is negative. In the, no one actually can be negative. No, the dt is negative here. Dt, remember t, I've written down somewhere here, is this. So t equals minus 2e squared 1 minus cosine theta, right? So dt is plus 2e squared d cosine theta. So that's minus 2e squared sine theta d theta. And so the fact that you've got a minus sign here is really because dt, the way I defined it, has a relative minus sign relative to the thing that you normally follow, which is the increase of theta. So that's nice and pretty. It's, it has all the, you could have guessed this, you could pretty much guess this from pure thought if you looked at the expression. The square bracket I talked about, the fact that it's breaking up into velocity contributions and propagators, you could have figured out just by looking at the graphs. T squared and U squared, you can argue from velocity conservation. The coefficient function alpha here, remember, is just E squared over 4 pi. So this is just counting 4 pi as a coupling constants. The 8 pi, the 2 pi and 8 pi you could figure out by keeping track of the 2 pi's. Number of colors had to be there. The S's you could follow from the, because they're coming to you in a predictable way. One S came from the overall flux factor in front of the answer, and the other S came from this change of variables in the phase space. So the factor of 4 is the thing that you couldn't have gotten without doing the S calculation, pretty much. It does. So now it's actually useful to think about this in various limits, because an awful lot of is known about this cross-section. And this approximation we use that the fermion masses are small is really a good one. Because almost all the history of the standard model comes from this cross-section. I love it. You guys see the cloakroom? I love the slide he had where he had a cup of coffee, Fermion Institute, and theory of everything, and Arrow was running. So we're the factory that makes theories of everything from coffee. Right, so what's this look like? So it's useful to think about different limits. So because that's actually historically what happened, that the whole answer is a function of S and T, and what are S? S is morally the energy of the collision, and as the colliders got better and better and better, the energies got higher and higher and higher. But before the late 70s, they never had energies that were comparable to the Zeta boson's mass. So when I was a graduate student, I remember people were on tenterhooks waiting for the, the SPS to turn on, because they were going to collide protons and antiprotons with energies finally large enough that you could produce Z's and W's and see if the standard model was true. And it was. But before that, so until the late 80s, electron-positron collisions couldn't happen until they all happened at energies that were low compared to the Z boson. And so you're always in a limit where S was much, much less than mz squared. And in that limit, if you go the extreme limit, then in these sums, you know, aij in that limit becomes dominated by, if s is very small, this thing is something which just goes to a constant limit. So this thing goes through the roof as s gets really small. So it becomes dominated by the electromagnetic current. In that case, this cross section is simplified dramatically, because this doesn't depend on the left or right. It's just something which is the same for everybody.
Yeah. And so it gives you a cross-section where A's are all going like 1 over S. So this is 1 over S squared. The whole cross-section. One of the things we should check is dimensions. Let's check dimensions. Sigma is a cross-section. It's a length squared. So sigma is a length squared. That means it goes like 1 over a mass squared. T goes like a mass squared. So the sigma dt should go like 1 over a mass to the fourth. And there's something wrong here, right? Because S goes like mass squared. So this dimension has the right dimensions with an A. The way I've written A has dimensions. So something's wrong. Let's just do the, so here we have dimensions. This is mass squared. This is mass squared, that's mass to the fourth. And we took away four masses, and so this is dimensionless. This should be dimensionless. So here we have one over, this is going 1 over S, this goes like 1 over S, this is 1 over S squared, and that's canceled dimensions out, so that's dimensionless, so that's fine. So the problem is over there. That's dimensionless. That's 1 over mass squared. And this is 1 over mass to the fourth.
Should times be squared?
What's that?
Should time be squared? Is that a term?
Which term?
Multiplied by
U squared. Oh, that's what I forgot. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. So where did that go? That's because I was an idiot, didn't write it. My problem as I get older is that I need to take my glasses off when I read, so I got the book in front of me. And it's, so those guys have a U squared, and these guys have a T squared. That's key. Now I'm going to get to. So in that case, so where were we here? Here. In that case, the sigma dt is simplifying down to its various factors, right? It's minus. So I can pull out Q e squared, which is 1, Q f squared, which is 1, minus 8 pi l squared, and c. We get s cubed because there's 1 over s squared from the a squared, there's 1 over s squared from the 4. And then this thing becomes, there's a factor of 2 because all these a's are the same. So I might as well pull out, make it 16. Okay, u squared is t squared. And eventually that works, right? That goes like 1 over s squared, and that's okay. Hey, Crystal, that's right. Except for the 2 pi's, what happened there? Pi squared, 8 pi, so when I, in the book, when I got to this point, I didn't have the 8 pi anymore, I didn't have the 8 anymore.
Yeah, I can't, it's just 1 over 8, and that's 8.
And I was squaring it, that was stupid, right? Right, so that should have, but then that actually kills all the pi, right? No, we have the pi squared, so it's pi alpha squared, and it's 1. Now that's right. God is great.
So let's say if we integrate over t, okay, what's the log range of t? Remember, t is this. So theta goes from 0 to pi. T is going from minus 4e squared to 0, right? So 0 less than theta pi corresponds to 0 gradient equal to t gradient down minus 4e squared. And minus 4e squared, remember, is minus s. So if you integrate over with respect to t, then you get a famous result. You get the expression for relativistic Babbitt scattering, or not Babbitt scattering, but d plus d minus potential bar, I guess. And I want to write it because I want to use it. So it's 4 pi alpha squared over 3s. So sigma is going to be the integral from minus 4 minus s to 0. Sigma to t. And that's going to be 4 pi alpha squared over 3. What I should do here is I should replace, u is equal to minus s minus t in this expression, because I use the delta function here to remove u. This is the famous answer. And it relies on s being much less than m z squared. It's like a magnetic scattering. And historically, this is, if you actually look at, for muons, this factor is 1. And so that this here would be the rate for sigma e plus e minus with an e plus e minus. So people often normalize things by that. So if you calculate it's useful to, what people did in the old days was they calculated, they looked at the ratio e plus e minus goes to hadrons. And they divided it by the r is 9 to be the cross section, by the cross section for e plus e minus. Goes to mu plus b minus. And that was a useful ratio because all the energy dependence was this overall factor, which was going to cancel the ratio. And so that should be, what this should come down to is, this should be the sum over all quarks of this factor is going to cancel in the ratio, but you have the charge square of the quark times the number of colors for each quark, which is a common factor, so that's the number of colors. Over charge square. And that was so what you'd expect to see here is something which cares about the number of quarks that are available as an energy, because you can't produce a pair of quarks if the energy of the mass of the quarks is bigger than the energy of the interaction. So you're expecting that if you plot this thing, this ratio, it should, as a function of energy, center mass energy, say, you're expecting to have approximate straight values, which is going to make jumps when a new quark becomes available to be produced. And when a new quark becomes available to be produced, there's going to be some resonances there, because if you have just exactly the right energy to produce those new quarks, you're going to produce them at rest. So there'll be something exotic will happen here and here. But in between, it should be roughly constant. And that constant should be telling you, a combination of it's related to just pure numbers, the number of colors, which you've seen already from other processes, it's 3. You know that from the we'll see later, from the pi zero decay rate, and you know that from also the rate for z to go into quark pairs. And other ways of getting at it. And then also it's counting the charge of the corresponding quarks. So this is doing some interesting thing, because it's for the up quarks, u was 2/3, right? And for the down quark, the strange quark, it was minus 1/3. So this sum of squares is an interestingly complicated fraction. And if you look at that, the book shows you a plot of the cross section. This is the measured cross section. So here's all the resonance crack. And then there's a range where there's 3 quarks would apply. That's the up down is strange. And then it kind of flattens out here for a range with 4 quarks. And there's interesting things that happens at the junctions. And that number there this straight line here is basically what you would have got from the up-down strange fork, and this is what you would get if you add the term fork. This is what you get when you add the bottom fork. And it really does give a reasonable description of the flat plateaus here, particularly up for the heavy forks. But here it's, there's a little bit of a displacement between the light forks, but that's because the strong corrections, as you get down, if the energies are below the mass of the charm fork, you're down below a GeV where the strong coupling constant is not so small. So the corrections that are due to the strong interactions become more important. So what happens is for the 4 and 5 fork case, you get a pretty good description of this flat area. And what you kind of slightly underestimate what is really going on. It's flat, basically, in the 3 fork case, but it's a little bit larger than you would have gotten from that formula because of the strong interaction corrections. But you do a very good job up here. So that's the first test that comes from E plus or minus scattering. Historically, this is also how people discovered the Z boson there. So at intermediate energies, this is again where S is less than and it's less than mz squared, but not completely negligibly less than mz squared. So in this limit aij will be, it'll start off being qe qf over s, but then the second term is not completely negligible. So I erase the second term. We have the overall factor of minus GG over sine squared of z squared. So GEI GFJ over sine theta cos theta times sine z squared. So the question is, how would you see this constant term buried inside this cross-section? In that ratio, this overall 1 over s is gone. If you actually plot the cross-section rather than this ratio, then the cross-section really does do, sigma against e really does blow up as you get the small e, because that really is the, you're seeing the mass of the photon there. So how would you pick this out of that huge cross-section, which is getting taken off because of that factor? Well, what you do is you take advantage of the fact that this is the first place where you see a dependence on left and right. So what you do is you find an observable which cares about left and rightness. So it's something which is parity violating. And so what people, what you could do is you could imagine, if you could measure the handedness of the final fermion, or if you could pair electrons that were polarized, in either way, you'd be able to, if you could measure the cross-section separately for the handedness of the fermion, then you can get an handle on this term, because this big term is dropping out of that difference. If you take the, say, the difference between the left-handed result from an electron and the right-handed result and subtract, then you're going to lose this term. And historically, they used, I can never remember this. Yeah, they polarized the electrons. So they calculate the cross-section for a left-hand electron minus the cross-section for a right-handed electron divided by the sum. These kind of things are useful because a lot of errors cancel in the ratio. So I call that A left-right. That's a function, in principle, it's a function of energy, because these are all functions of energy. But you can kind of see that that what happens is, in this cross-section, which I obscured again, the overall factor in front dies, and all you're seeing is this, or maybe you can see over here. All you're seeing is the square bracket. You're seeing the left-handed result. The left-handed result is being given by this expression, where the left-handed slot is an L. So the left-hand result is ALL squared times U squared plus ALR squared times T squared. And the right-hand result is ARR squared times U squared and ARL squared times T squared. And so if you take the difference in the sum, you see that you're not getting zero because you're going to pick up differences in sums between these A's. So if you you put that in, it turns out to be in this approximation that's given by minus S over mz squared. Because this S is coming from the fact that this sum is going to one over S, so that you're dividing by a big thing. So we've got g e left squared times g right squared. So something which would have been zero if the z hadn't existed. It's not zero at low energy, but it's plus u. It's suppressed, but it has a predictable coefficient and a predictable energy dependence. And that's exactly what you see. As you see. So if you plot the cross-section, the whole cross-section against S, starts off going to infinity because of the 1 over S term. You can see there's also going to be a problem when S is equal to the Z mass, because we're going to be dividing by zero at that point. So something has to happen there too, which I'll come back to. So if this is mz squared here, something has to happen. The formula I gave is actually diverging at that point. For very large S, the whole answer is going like 1 over S, cross section going like 1 over S, because dimensionally, that's the only thing. If S is large, masses are small, the only scale in the problem is S. So this has to go like 1 over S when the energy gets large. So that goes like 1 over U squared. And so this is applying in this regime. And so you can see that the asymmetry, this particular asymmetry, gives you evidence about the coupling of the Z. And it's not, it's not dominated by photon coupling. Something happens in here. The formula we're using has to break down because having an infinite result here doesn't make any sense. So that's one of the next things we'll talk about is what's going on there. So something's going to go on which caps this thing off at a large. This is going to kind of be something which is order 1 over alpha in size. And that's why it's hard to get into perturbation theory. And so the approximation we're using is failing us a little bit. So this is the resonance I was talking about. And that structure of the resonance will be where I'll show you why this is connected to the width of the Z boson. And then right now, you can do this up to the energies that are quite high. So this whole shape has been mapped out. And there's an awful lot known about the cross-section at resonance, because that's where they sat for a long time. Because the cross-section is so large, you just produce lots of Zs. And you get to count them, and you can reduce your errors a lot. So an awful lot is known about what's going on at resonance. And so it's going to be worth understanding how this thing turns over so that we can make formulas for all the stuff which specialize for the case where S is equal to mz, because that again also involves just these couplings and not other factors that are complicated, the masses of things, but just pure numbers to do with the quantum numbers of the fermions. And so the tests of the standard model are happening here, 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 and to a certain extent out here, because the shape of this thing as you get up to larger S is related to what's going on at the resonance. That's where we'll go over the next couple of lectures. But it's not a big deal, right? Once you cap it, you're basically done. And not only are you done for this, you for free have the scattering result for once we talk about process symmetry, for any process at all, let's just talk about those two graphs that interfere with each other and limit to the fermion masses as small. We'll have to separately look at the cases where there's also a T-channel graph, like when these are all electrons. And that's an additional complication, but it's not a big deal. Any questions about that?